All right, we're looking at chapter 37 and 38. Chapter 37 through 50, if somebody asks you, what are those chapters about in the book of Genesis? What would be your answer?
Joseph.
That would be my answer, but that's not the way it starts out. Look at chapter 37. Now Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned, in the land of Canaan. These are the records of the generations of Jacob. And yet, he tells the story of Joseph. We had that on your lesson there, under that first section, Generations of Jacob. And that these 37 through 50, those chapters are built around Joseph. And yes, that's true, because the generations of Jacob, or the history of Jacob, is intertwined and dependent on the story of Joseph. So as you began to look through this section, for example, in 37:28, and this answers one of our questions that we have on the lesson number 2, but look at chapter 37:28. There's a little statement right at the end of the verse. Remember that Moses is writing this later. And remember that he's writing by the power of the Holy Spirit. And he tells about this betrayal of his brothers, selling him into slavery. And then it says, thus they brought Joseph to Egypt. They brought Joseph to Egypt. They just sold him to some slave traders. Was it their intent to get him to Egypt? Did they care where he ended up? Nah. We've been talking about through this book the divine providence of God working behind the scenes. When you pray, you can pray in consciousness of the divine providence of God working in your life today. We don't have a prophet to tell us what's going on. But God is still working in the lives of men and women. They brought him to Egypt. Even though they were wicked, God used these boys to accomplish that purpose. So when you get over to chapter 45, we have that on your lesson there. When he's reunited with his brothers and makes himself known to them, in verse 5, 45, verse 5, he tells his brothers, now do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me. Now 37:28 said, who sent him? The brothers. This says God sent him, which is true.
Both.
God sent him through his wicked brothers. And so God sent me before you. Why? To preserve life. We've talked about that in some previous classes. Had this story of Joseph not occurred, we may not be reading about Jacob, because there was a famine in the land. They were running out of food. To preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years. There are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. Go over to chapter 50, right at the end of the book, and verse 20. We've said they were wicked boys. They had wicked intents. Joseph acknowledges that right here. As for you, you meant evil against me. And they did. But God meant it for good. God can take the evil intents of people and turn it around to use for His purposes. But God meant it for good. Now note, in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive. So because they went to Egypt, what happened in Egypt when you start reading Exodus chapter 1? Do you recall? They became a great nation. They multiplied. That's what God had promised Abraham. That's what God had told Jacob. You go to Egypt, I'll make of you a great nation there. But all of that was dependent on the story of Joseph. And so as we start chapter 37, verse 2, these are the generations of, or your version may say, this is the history of Jacob. And indeed it is. Because his history depends upon this story about Joseph. All right, so here we have Joseph when 17 years of age, was pastoring the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought back a bad report about them to their father. Sometimes, and I don't know the answer to this, but just something to think about, sometimes singulars are used for plurals, and I'm wondering if bad report is not used from the standpoint of there were a number of things, and it just wasn't a good report about his brothers. Back in chapter 34, we read about his brothers doing something really evil. What was it? Chapter 34.
Isn't it the rape?
Yeah, this is the story with Dinah. And you remember that Simeon and Levi, at least, although it says Jacob's sons, maybe all of them were involved in the deception, except maybe one. Because Jacob's sons, oftentimes, you have the whole for a part. And I don't know that Joseph was involved back then. What would have been his age when that happened with Dinah? How old was Dinah?
Somewhere between 12 and 17.
12 and 17. So he'd have been somewhere in that age. And if it was when she was 12 or 14, he'd have been just a boy compared to, they're all boys, but a young boy compared to his brothers. So I don't know that he had a part in that. We can't be definite. I'm saying don't base it on the term Jacob's sons. But so they deceived the Shechemites into being circumcised so they could kill them, and Simeon and Levi did that. And then they went and plundered the city, took their wives and children. So here we see Joseph being pictured as among the brothers, the one who's at least seemingly trying to live a good life. And he brings back a bad report about his brothers. So when brothers hear that one brother goes back and tattles, what happens with the brothers?
They hate him.
Ah, there's ill will, isn't there? That's right. And so they go back and they bring back this bad report, or he brings back this bad report about his brothers. And so we set the stage now for the next verse. There. And when you get to verse 3, now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons. Because he was a good boy?
Because he was born of Rachel.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
Okay, because he was the son of his old age. Do parents ever show favoritism to the youngest child? I bet we got some older siblings here that say, yes, they do. It's an old, old trap, isn't it? Because he was the son of his old age. And he made him a varicolored tunic. Sometimes parents are older. I'm not saying that's true in Jacob's case because he was a wealthy man, but sometimes parents are able to do more for the youngest child because they're at a different stage in life. Back, for example, when my brothers were boys, my dad and mom didn't make a whole lot. And well, it might be what you consider poor. When I came along, he was a lot better stage in life than he was when my brothers were boys. There's 22 years difference between me and my oldest brother. So anyway, in this particular case, there's not that much difference between Joseph and his brother, six or seven years between him and his oldest brother. But nevertheless, now then, his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers. So they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms. Wouldn't that be a great place to have supper? Be part of that family. And so we have a picture of family life that is certainly not good. And when boys grow up in a family where there's bitterness and ill will and bickering and bad things being said, how can that impact them? Can they get bitter toward the family? Can they get bitter toward the daddy? In fact, can they get bitter toward God? This is what Joseph grew up with. Now remember, we already had the incident a few years earlier, whether he was 12 or whether he was 16, whatever it was, where his brothers committed this act with the Shechemites, not only deception, but two of them guilty of murder, and they maybe all involved in the plundering. And now we have this. Of course, his daddy was a model of morality, wasn't he?
No.
His daddy had been the classic deceiver, had he not? What about his uncle, Laban?
He's a bad person.
Another deceiver, right? His daddy, his uncle. Well, what about his mother? She was always on a high plane, wasn't she?
No.
No, she's full of jealousy toward Leah. And when they left Padan Aram, what did she take with her?
Idols.
So there's his daddy, there's his uncle, there's his mother, you have his brothers. Good grief. How can this young boy ever survive and lead any kind of a moral and godly life? And the more I study about Joseph's surroundings and I see all these things, the more I come to have an appreciation for who he was. Besides the fact of his family, sometimes children are unstable because their parents move around a lot. Joseph's 17. Do you remember some of the places he's lived so far? Where was he born? Padan Aram, right? Then they moved to Succoth. Then they moved to Shechem. Then they worked in Bethel. And then Bethlehem on the journey down to Hebron. And now in Hebron. So here's all these places in 17 years of life. So this family, where he lived, the various places he lived. And yet, when we read about Joseph in chapter 37 and through the rest of the book, we see a young man of faith in God and moral courage. He did not let his surroundings mold who he was. He did not let his brothers mold who he was. He didn't let his uncle mold who he was. He even didn't apparently adopt the bad practices of his own mother. And certainly not that of his brother. So this is the young man that's just such a model. And it ought to be an encouragement to parents. That if we can ever just instill faith in God. That was the key. It was not his bloodline. It was not his genetics. It's his faith in God that lifted him above his surroundings. If we can instill that in our children, it'll go with them to college. It'll go with them when they get married. It'll go with them wherever they are. That's the key, his faith in God. And we'll see that as we go through the chapters that we'll be following. All right, so, verse 5, then Joseph had a dream. Now, the New American Standard uses the word then at the beginning of verse 5. But obviously, you're diligent Bible students, so what did you do when you studied this chapter?
Compared
versions, right? We keep saying compare versions. The word then suggests consecutive, but it's not necessarily consecutive. And in several of the versions, instead of the word then, you'll have and, like the King James American Standard has and. The New King James has now. New Revised has once. Why am I mentioning this? Because it's possible that this is another of the classic examples that we've run throughout Genesis, that everything is not written in chronological order. There's indications that what these dreams Joseph had that are now being recorded actually took place previously. So what are they? Well, let's read it. So we asked you on the lesson, what were the two dreams that he had? And the first one is about stalks, wasn't it? So he said, verse 7, we're binding sheaves in the field. My sheaf rose up and stood erect. Behold, your sheaf gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf. Well, this really struck his brothers well, didn't it? His brothers said to him, are you actually going to reign over us? Are you really going to rule over us? You know what would be interesting? To have a recording of how they said it. The tone of their voice. Have a video of the expression on their faces. No telling what the grimace was. What the tone of their voices were. But nevertheless, so they hated him even more. Back up in verse 5. They hated him even more. Back up in verse 4. Already they hated him. So this is not just a mild dislike. This is really, really getting bad. They hated him even more. All right, verse 9, he had still another dream and related it to his brothers and said, lo, I've had still another dream, and behold, the sun and moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me. He related it to his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, what is this dream that you have had? Shall I, that would be the sun evidently, and your mother, that would be the moon seemingly in the dream, and your brothers actually come to bow ourselves down before you to the ground? His brothers were jealous. Hard to get an uglier sin, maybe, than jealousy. We've talked about that in previous classes. Jealousy is what caused the Jews to persecute Christians, especially the rulers. Is what caused the Pharisees to hate Jesus and get him nailed to a cross. Jealousy, terrible, terrible sin. But nevertheless, they were jealous. And so, but there's a little statement here in verse 11. So it says in verse 10, his father rebuked him. But there's that little statement in verse 11. His father kept the saying in mind. Over in Matthew, in Luke, when Jesus was found there in the temple answering the questions, and they had to go look for him. There's a little statement about Mary. His mother treasured all these things in her heart. You know, when he was born, there was Simeon the prophet and Anna the prophetess and all of these people involved in all of that. How much of that was in her heart to remember? And you wonder how down through the years of his life she thought about those things. And then here he is nailed to a cross. But nevertheless, here's Jacob. So here's this statement. How many times did he think about that after Joseph was gone, about this dream? You know, dreams, I have dreams. I'm glad they don't happen. If I can even remember. Maybe that's all this was. Maybe he had a bad supper. How do you know? It was or wasn't?
Because it came true.
That's how you know. You got a history. It came true. And which says that God was involved in some way in this dream. How that God does that, I can't tell you. But the fact is, he told him, he told his brothers, before it happened, not after it happened. Oh, y'all remember I had a dream back? No, he told them before it happened with some degree of detail because he had his father and his mother and his brothers. Now, there's a problem with that mother business, isn't there? Is his mother alive?
No.
She's dead. And so, why does he say your mother and your brothers? All right. This is where I suggest to you that he may have had these dreams sometime earlier. Maybe when Rachel was pregnant with Benjamin before she died. I don't know. But he says your mother and your brothers. And so if it was during that period when they were journeying back to Hebron that he had that dream and it included the mother as well as the brothers, that would explain what he's saying here. I don't know if that's the case, but nevertheless, it's possible that these dreams he had predated the record that you're now reading. Okay, so it would also help to serve to explain what happened in verse 12 following, as well as the previous verse, 2 and 3, why their hatred was so bitter to him because of these dreams that he had already related to them. So, verse 12, his brothers went out to pasture their father's flock at Shechem, which was in Samaria. And so he sends them out to see about his brothers at Shechem. And then you see in verse 15, he's wandering in the field. He's looking for them. Don't know where they're at. Can't find them. And so somebody, a man asked him, what you looking for? And he says, he told him what he's looking for. Looking for his brothers pasturing these herds of these sheep. And so they said, well, he's moved up to Dothan. Best I could tell, Dothan was about 11 miles north of Samaria. And I don't know how accurate that is, but that's what I found in several sources. So, you know, we think Dothan, oh, that's just right over there. Well, 11 miles is nothing for you and me, is it? What if you had to walk 11 miles? That's a little different story, isn't it? And so they've moved over to Dothan. And so he goes over to Dothan to find his brother. So verse 18, they saw him from a distance. So there he is. There's that dreamer. And before he came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. So here you see conspiracy, first of all. Jealousy led to conspiracy. And they said to one another, here comes this dreamer. Now then, come, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits, and we'll say a wild beast has devoured him. Then we'll see what become of the dream. Wait a minute. Wait. I thought these were the boys that back in chapter 34, when they found out about their sister, back in 34, verse 7, when Jacob told them what had been done with Dinah, what did they say about that right at the end of the verse? This ought not be done. And then they're doing this? What? Should this be done? No. Not only not in Israel, not anywhere. Any nation. Not only in Israel. And so they plot to put him to death. And then lie about it. You got jealousy. You got hatred, you got conspiracy, you got lying, you got the intent to murder. What a fine bunch of brothers. All right, then, Reuben, which is the oldest boy, heard this and rescued him out of their hands, said, let us not take his life. And Reuben further said to them, shed no blood, throw him into this pit that is in the wilderness. Yeah, that's the step to take as an older brother, isn't it? Why didn't he say, guys, this ain't going to happen? Was he afraid? Did he lack the moral courage? He had a little, I guess. I'm going to save Joseph. Remember, we talked about this in a previous class. Don't let blood keep you from taking a stand. Back when this happened with Shechem, at Shechem with Levi and his brother, and they went in there and killed all the people. Where was the other brothers? Why don't they take a stand about that? So, in any case, he said, well, let's throw him in the pit. But he intended to rescue him at least. There's some redeeming quality in his plan. And where he went after that, I don't know. But he wasn't around when the next events happened, evidently. So when Joseph reached his brothers, they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the very colored tunic that was on him. What must that have been like? You're 17 years old. You go to meet your brothers. They violently assault you, take off your coat, throw you into a pit, it says. So the pit was empty, verse 24, and they sat down and ate a meal. No compassion. What kind of brothers can throw their brother in a pit and say, hey, let's eat? That shows the state of their heart, does it not? You'd think at least trouble them a little bit. They sat down and ate a meal. And as they raised their eyes and looked, behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead with their camels, bringing aromatic gum and balm and myrrh on their way to bring them down to Egypt. And so Judah said to his brethren, "What profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." Through what tribe did Jesus come?
Judah.
What a nice ancestor. Through Judah. So Judah said, "Let's just sell him into slavery." And so they pulled him up, lifted Joseph out of the pit. You wonder, can you imagine a modern novel about this? Would it be a few words? It'd be a big book, wouldn't it? That all the pleading probably that went on, the tears, the struggle, no telling what. The book's not written to satisfy our curiosity. Designed to guide our lives, to do what we prayed about with Mitch, to learn things that'll help us live for God. And so all of these things that we might be interested in are not dealt with. All right, so they sold him to the Ishmaelite for 20 shekels of silver. Boy, they really prized their brother's life, didn't they? And thus they brought Joseph into Egypt. So Reuben returns, finds him gone. He tears his clothes. So what am I going to do? So verse 31, they take his tunic, slaughtered a male goat, dipped the tunic in blood, sent the varied colored tunic, and brought it to their father and said, "We have found this. Please examine it to see whether it's your son's tunic or not." Deception. He examined and said, "It is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." Jacob tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days, it says. Where is there no tender heart for their daddy? How old is Jacob? We went through this last class. Did you bring your calculators? About 35, right?
Yeah.
108. Around 108. And he's weeping. His heart is broken because of their lie. And they don't tell him anything. And you'll see as time passes, even when they stand before Joseph, they're still hanging on to their story instead of fessing up. So, so his sons and his daughters rose to comfort him. Now, why are they going to tell him to comfort him? More lies? But he refused to be comforted. They said, and he said, "Surely I'll go down to Sheol in mourning for my son." So his father wept for him. And then, meanwhile, the Midianites sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard. You talk about these dreams. Do you remember another young man who had dreams that said something or visions about the future?
Daniel,
that's right. He started out by interpreting dreams, didn't he? The dreams of the king, King Nebuchadnezzar. So God used dreams to communicate the future to Nebuchadnezzar, but Nebuchadnezzar, of course, didn't know what it meant. His magicians couldn't tell him what it meant. So Daniel was called in. And then you have the first six chapters of Daniel, where Daniel interprets these dreams. And they're historical in significance. You have the last part where Daniel has these visions that sound like something out of some modern movie today. Why would you even believe the last part? Because of the first six chapters. Because the first six chapters are historical, deal with historical data. And those things happened. And so thus Daniel was confirmed to be a prophet of God, able to interpret dreams that God had a hand in letting men know something about the future. Hold your finger here at Genesis 38. Go to Hebrews 1:1. After he spoke long ago to the fathers in the prophets, I note that last phrase, in many portions and in many ways. So he would make revelations in different ways to the prophets of old. sometime by vision, sometime by dreams, etc. Sometime by direct influence on their hearts and minds, like most of the prophets that we read about in the Bible. But there are various ways that God would communicate His will through these prophets. Okay. Now, chapter 38. So we're ready. Now we got at the end of 37. We got Joseph into Egypt, sold to Potiphar. Go to chapter 39:1. Where does 39:1 pick up? Where 37 leaves off, right? Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. So end of 37, they sell him to Midianites, who then sold him to Potiphar. And then we have 39:1. But then you have this intervening chapter. So it sounds like the end of 37 and then whatever time it took to get to Egypt and sell him to Potiphar. So what would that be? A few weeks, maybe, a few days. I don't know, whatever that journey would take, whatever that transaction would take. But you got a problem again when you read chapter 39. You have this story about Judah. Oh, by the way, you reckon he was one of those boys that said back there in chapter 34, this ought not be done in Israel. But look what Judah does. We already read earlier about Reuben. What did Reuben do? We read that in 35. Slept with his dad's concubine. So here's Judah. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah. So of the first four boys, here's two of them. And so Simeon and Levi, they're great, aren't they? That's the deal at Shechem. There's Reuben. He sleeps with his father's concubine. Here's this Judah. All right. So here's Joseph with these kind of four older brothers. Aren't they great? And so Judah departed from his brother to visit a certain Adullamite. Adullamite is a man who lived in Adullam, that place, whose name was Hira. Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite, whose name was Shua. He took her and went into her. So he conceived and bore a son, named him Ur. She conceived again and bore a son, named him Onan. She still bore another son, named him Shelah. Stop with me a minute. How much time has passed between verse 1 and 5? At a minimum. You know, if you had these children one right after the other, you got 27 to 30 months, huh? But wait a minute. We ended chapter 37 and began chapter 39. Now we've already got nearly 3 years. Well, it's not finished. Then it says, Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, named her Tamar. So that Tamar is his daughter-in-law. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was evil in the sight of the Lord. What did he do? I don't know. Holy Spirit didn't decide. It decided it wasn't necessary for us to know. He said he's evil, and the Lord took his life. Then you have Onan. That was the brother's duty, going to your brother's wife. Later, that's stated in the law, by the way, Deuteronomy. But here it was even practiced before the law. Going to your brother's wife and perform your duty as a brother-in-law, that is, to raise up offspring. So he'll have an offspring, so he'll have a lineage, the idea. And that was a duty under the law. But Onan knew the offspring would not be his, so he went to his brother's wife. He wasted his seed on the ground in order not to give offspring to his brother. What he did was displeasing the sight of the Lord, so he took his life also. Two boys down. And we got a third one. We got Shelah. So Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up. How long will that take? I don't know. I don't know how old Shelah was at this time after these other two boys died. But let's say he was only 3 years old, whatever it was, 5 years old. I don't know. Tamar had to wait a while, wouldn't she? And so if he was 10 years old, she still got to wait a while. But it says, wait until he's grown up and I'll give you to him. So I'm afraid, because he thought, I'm afraid he too may die like his brothers. So then you have this story unfolding. After a considerable time, don't know how long that is, after a considerable time, Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. The time of mourning was ended. Judah went up to his sheep shears at Timnah, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. It was told to Tamar, behold, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah. So verse 14, she removed her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil, and wrapped herself and sat in the gateway of Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah, for she saw that Shelah had grown up, and she had not been given to him as his wife. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot, for she had covered her face. If you go down here on Jensen in Houston and see a harlot, she got her face covered and wearing all kinds of stuff, cover her up? No. Can you pretty well pick them out, though? I know you're not about to answer that question. I've never been down there. I don't know. You just drive down the street, and you know, there they are. You know what they're doing. They dress the part. And so look at the difference in customs, is what I'm pointing out. In their custom, the way this woman dressed, although it's nothing like what a harlot dressed today, said without a sign, I'm available. The way you dress can send a message. A lesson. The way women today dress, the way mothers and fathers let their daughters dress, can send a message. I'm available. I'm interested in something sensual without saying a word. It did in this case. It did in Proverbs 7. What a lesson about the power of dress. When Adam and Eve became conscious of the power of nakedness, what did they do? They covered up. They covered up. Try it.
And there was no one else to
see them. Nadine said there was no one else to see them. Okay. And but they were aware of the power of nakedness. So interesting. Okay, so so he has a sexual relationship with this prostitute, and she becomes pregnant. That's one of the dangers of sexual relationships, isn't it? What did David do with Bathsheba? Committed adultery. So what's the big deal? Night together. What's the problem?
Didn't come murder.
Why?
Because she got pregnant.
She got pregnant. Uh-oh. Got pregnant. That's one of the problems. Yeah, I'll cover it all up, but sometimes there's other problems.
God took care of that one too.
Sir?
God took care of that one too.
Yes, he did. You're right. Bill said God took care of that one too. That's correct. So here's Bathsheba. By the way, what made him interested in Bathsheba?
Taking a bath.
Taking a bath on the housetop. I don't know. That's interesting. I guess on how he saw her. So, again, sight. I don't know if she was advertising or just injudicious, but be that as it may. So he didn't know it was Tamar. She's all covered up. And she wanted it that way. So, he told her he'd give her a young goat, verse 17, but she wanted more. She was already planning. She's way ahead of him. Will you give a pledge until you send it? What pledge shall I give you? She said, your seal and your card and your staff that's in your hand. So he gave it to her, went into her, and she conceived by him. There's another problem, having a relationship with a prostitute. Men spend, don't tell how much money, give up things for the sexual relationship. Book of Proverbs talks about that in Proverbs chapter 5. It's an old, old problem with people. It's always been, always will be, I guess, until Jesus comes again. But we can learn some lessons about it as we study these passages. So anyway, so finally, verse 20, Judah sent the young goat by his friend the Adullamite to receive the pledge from the woman's hand, but he didn't find her. I thought Judah's response was interesting. He asked the men of her place, saying, "Where's the temple prostitute who was by the road to Nahum?" But they said, "There's been no temple prostitute here." If he thought she was a temple prostitute, what does that say he thought about her religion? Wasn't religion of the God he's supposed to serve, was it? But you know, when you throw your morals away, what difference does it make what you profess anyhow? In any case, they said there's no temple prostitute here. So he returned to Judah and said, "Oh, I'm so sorry what I've done. I don't know how I'm going to get this straightened out. I want God to forgive me." Is that what he said? No, he said, verse 23, "Let her keep him. Otherwise, we'll become a laughingstock. After all, I sent this young goat, but you did not find her." So in other words, just forget it. Folks, listen. That's exactly what happens in relationships today. Men will cheat on their wives. And when they're discovered, "Oh, okay, it happened. Let's forget it and move on." It's not that easy. So, in any case, you can see the attitude that displayed. So about 3 months later, Judah was informed, "Your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the harlot. Behold, she was child of harlotry." Boy, now Judah is such a godly man. He loves the Lord so much. He says, "Bring her out and let her be burned." We can't tolerate that kind of conduct here. Isn't that great? Here, I'll pick on preachers a little while. I happen to know for a fact that there are men who will stand in the pulpit, preach against immodesty, immorality, and all the time they're sleeping, maybe with a member of the congregation, and preaching a strong sermon. What hypocrisy. Well, anyway, I'm out of time, so real quickly, the story. She gave birth to Perez. When you read the genealogy in Matthew and Luke, Perez is in the genealogy. How did Perez get there? Tamar. Where did she come about? She's not even an Israelite. Thus, chapter 38. We've been saying that Moses will put things in the book as a foundation for something in the future. That's exactly what you have here. Okay, our time is up. Thank you.